Aeneid 4, Part 3, 475 to 707. And so Dido was overwhelmed by grief and possessed by madness. She decided to die and planned in her mind the time and the means. She went and spoke to her sorrowing sister, with her face composed to conceal her plan, and her brow bright with hope. "My dear Anna, rejoice with your sister. I have found a way to bring him back to me in love, or else to free me from him. Near Oceanus and the setting of the sun is the home of the Ethiopians, the most distant part of our earth, where mightiest Atlas turns on his shoulders the axis of the sky, studded with its burning stars. From here, they say, there comes a Massylian priestess who was the guardian of the temple of the Hesperides. She used to keep watch over the branches of the sacred tree and bring rich foods for the serpent, spreading the oozing honey and sprinkling the sleep-bringing seeds of the poppy. She undertakes to free me by her spells the mind of anyone she wishes, and to send cruel cares to others, to stop the flow of rivers and turn stars back in their courses. At night she raises the spirits of the dead, and you will see the ash trees coming down from the mountains and hear the earth bellow beneath your feet. I call the gods and your own sweet self to witness, O my dearest sister, that it's not by my own will that I have recourse to magic arts. Go now, telling no one, and build up a pyre under the open sky in the inner courtyard of the palace, and lay on it the armour this traitor has left hanging on the walls of my room, everything there is of his remaining, and the marriage bed on which I was destroyed. I want to wipe out everything that can remind me of such a man, and that is what the priestess advises." She spoke, and spoke no more. Her face grew pale, but Anna did not understand that these strange rites were a pretense, and that her sister meant to die. She had no inkling that such madness had seized Dido, no reason to fear that she would suffer more than she had at the death of Sychaeus. She did what she was asked. But the queen knew what the future held. As soon as the pine torches and the home oak were hewn, and the huge pyre raised under the open sky in the very heart of the palace, she hung the place with garlands and crowned the pyre with funeral branches. Then she laid on a bed an effigy of Aeneas, with his sword and everything of his he had left behind. There were altars all around, and the priestess, with hair streaming, called with a voice of thunder upon 300 gods, Erebus, Chaos, Triple Hecate, and Virgin Diana of the Three Faces. She had also sprinkled water to represent the spring of Lake Avernus. She also sought out potent herbs with a milk of black poison in their rich stems, and harvested them by moonlight with a bronze sickle. She found, too, a love charm torn from the forehead of a newborn foal before the mare could bite it off. Dido herself took meal in her hands and worshipped, standing by the altars with one foot freed from all fastenings and her dress unbound, calling before she died to gods and stars to be witnesses to her fate, and praying to whatever just and mindful power there is that watches over lovers who have been betrayed. It was night, and weary living things were peacefully taking their rest upon the earth. The woods and wild waves of ocean had been stilled. The stars were rolling on in mid-course. Silence reigned over field and flock, and all the gaily coloured birds were laid to sleep in the quiet of night, those that haunt broad lakes and those that crowd the thickets dotted over the countryside. But not Dido. Her heart was broken, and she found no relief in sleep. Her eyes and mind would not accept the night, but her torment redoubled, and her raging love came again and again in great surging tides of anger. These are the thoughts she dwelt upon. This is what she kept turning over in her heart. So then, what am I to do? Shall I go back to those who once wooed me to see if they will have me? I would be a laughing-stock. Shall I beg a husband from the Numidians after I have so often scorned their offers of marriage? Shall I then go with the Trojan fleet and do whatever the Trojans ask? I suppose they would be delighted to take me after all the help I have given them. They are sure to remember what I have done and be properly grateful. No, even if I were willing to go with them, they will never allow a woman they hate to come aboard their proud ships. There is nothing left for you, Dido. Do you not know, have you not yet noticed, the treacheries of the race of Laomedon? But if they did agree to take me, what then? Shall I go alone into exile with a fleet of jubilant sailors? Or shall I go in force with all my Tyrian bands crowding at my side? It was not easy for me to uproot them from their homes in the city of Sidon. How can I make them take to the sea again and order them to hoist sail into the winds? No, you must die. That is what you have deserved. Let the sword be the cure for your suffering. You could not bear, Anna, to see your sister weeping. When the madness was taking me, you were the first to lay this load upon my back and put me at the mercy of my enemy. I was not allowed to live my life without marriage, in innocence, like a wild creature, and be untouched by such anguish as this. I have not kept faith with the ashes of Sychaeus. While these words of grief were bursting from Dido's heart, Aeneas was now resolved to leave, and was taking his rest on the high stern of his ship with everything ready for sailing. There, as he slept, appeared before him the shape of the god, coming to him with the same features as before, and once again giving advice, in every way like Mercury. The voice, the radiance, the golden hair, the youthful beauty of his body. Son of the goddess, how can you lie there sleeping at a time like this? Do you not see danger all around you at this moment? Have you lost your wits? Do you not hear the west wind blowing off the shore? Having decided to die, she is turning her schemes over in her mind and planning some desperate act, stirring up the storm tides of her anger. Why do you not go now with all speed, while speed you may? If morning comes and finds you loitering here, you will soon see her ships churning the sea and deadly torches blazing and the shore seething with flames. Come then, no more delay. Women are unstable creatures, always changing. When he had spoken, he melted into the blackness of night, and Aeneas was immediately awake, terrified by the sudden apparition. There was no more rest for his men as he roused them to instant action. "Wake up and sit to your benches," he shouted. "Let out the sails and quick about it. A god has been sent down again from the heights of heaven. I have just seen him, spurring us on to cut our plaited ropes and run from here. We are following you, O blessed god, whoever you are. Once again we obey your commands and rejoice. Stand by us and graciously help us. Put favouring stars in the sky for us." As he spoke, he drew his sword from its scabbard like a flash of lightning and struck the mooring cables with the naked steel. In that instant, they were all seized by the same ardour and set to hauling and hustling. The shore was emptied. The sea could not be seen for ships. Bending to the oars, they whipped up the foam and swept the blue surface of the sea. Aurora was soon leaving the saffron bed of Tithonus and beginning to sprinkle new light upon the earth. The Queen saw from her high tower the first light whitening, and the fleet moving out to sea with its sails square to the following winds. She saw the deserted shore and harbour, and not an oarsman in sight. Three times and more she beat her lovely breasts and tore her golden hair, crying, "O Jupiter, will this intruder just go and make a mockery of our kingdom? Why are they not running to arms and coming from all over the city to pursue him? And others should be rushing ships out of the docks. Move! Bring fire and quick about it! Give out the weapons! Heave on the oars! What am I saying? Where am I? What madness is this that changes my resolve? Poor Dido, you have done wrong, and it is only now coming home to you. You should have thought of this when you were offering him your sceptre. So much for his right hand, so much for his pledge, the man who is supposed to be carrying with him the gods of his native land, and to have lifted his weary old father up onto his shoulders. Could I not have taken him and torn him limb from limb, and scattered the pieces in the sea? Could I not have put his men to the sword, and Ascanius too, and served his flesh at his father's table? I know the outcome of a battle would have been in doubt. So it would have been in doubt. Was I, who am about to die, afraid of anyone? I would have taken torches to his camp and filled the decks of his ships with fire, destroying the son and the father and the whole Trojan people before throwing myself on the flames. O heavenly sun, whose fires pass in review all the works of this earth, and you, Juno, who have been witness and party to all the anguish of this love, and Hecate, whose name is heard in nightly howling at crossroads all over our cities, and the avenging Furies, and you, the gods of dying Dido, listen to these words. Give a hearing to my sufferings, for they are great, and hear my prayers, heed my prayers. If that monster of wickedness must reach harbour, if he must come to shore, and that is what the fates of Jupiter demand, if the boundary stone is set and may not be moved, then let him be harried in war by a people bold in arms. May he be driven from his own land and torn from the embrace of Aeolus. May he have to beg for help and see his innocent people dying. Then, after he has submitted to the terms of an unjust peace, let him not enjoy the kingdom he longs for, or the life he longs to lead, but let him fall before his time and lie unburied on the broad sand. This is my prayer. With these last words I pour out my life's blood. As for you, my Tyrians, you must pursue with hatred the whole line of his descendants in time to come. Make that your offering to my shade. Let there be no love between our peoples, and no treaties. Arise from my dead bones, O my unknown avenger, and harry the race of Dardanus with fire and sword wherever they may settle, now and in the future, whenever our strength allows it. I pray that we may stand opposed, shore against shore, sea against sea, and sword against sword. Let there be war between the nations and between their sons for ever. Even as she spoke, Dido was casting about in her mind how she could most quickly put an end to the life she hated. She then addressed these few words to Sichaeus' nurse, Barche, for the black ashes of her own now lay far away in her ancient homeland. My dear nurse, send my sister Anna quickly to me, telling her to sprinkle her body with river water, and take with her the animals and the other offerings as instructed. That is how she is to come, and your own forehead must be veiled with a sacred ribbon. I have prepared with due care offerings to Jupiter of the Styx, and I am now of a mind to complete them, and put an end to the pain of love by giving the pyre of this Trojan to the flames." The old woman bustled away, leaving Dido full of wild fears at the thought of what she was about to do. Her cheeks trembling and flecked with red, her bloodshot eyes rolling, she was pale with the pallor of approaching death. Rushing through the door into the inner courtyard, she climbed the high pyre in a frenzy and unsheathed the Trojan sword for which she had asked, though not for this purpose. Then her eyes lit on the Trojan clothes and the bed she knew so well, and pausing for a moment to weep and to remember, she lay down on the bed and spoke these last words. "These are the possessions of Aeneas, which I so loved while gods and the fates allowed it. Let them receive my spirit and free me from this anguish. I have lived my life and completed the course that fortune has set before me, and now my great spirit will go beneath the earth. I have founded a glorious city and lived to see the building of my own walls. I have avenged my husband and punished his enemy, who was my brother. I would have been happy, more than happy, if only Trojan keels had never grounded on our shores." She then buried her face for a moment in the bed and cried, "We shall die unavenged, but let us die. This is how it pleases me to go down among the shades. Let the Trojan who knows no pity gaze his fill upon this fire from the high seas and take with him the omen of my death." So she spoke, and while speaking, fell upon the sword. Her attendants saw her fall. They saw the blood foaming on the blade and staining her hands, and filled the high walls of the palace with their screaming. Rumour ran raving like a bacchant through the stricken city. The palace rang with lamentation and groaning and the wailing of women, and the heavens gave back the sound of mourning. It was as though the enemy were within the gates, and the whole of Carthage or old Tyre were falling with flames raging and rolling over the roofs of men and gods. Anna heard and was beside herself. She came rushing in terror through the middle of the crowd, tearing her face and beating her breast, calling out her sister's name as she lay dying. "So this is what it meant. It was all to deceive your sister. This was the purpose of the pyre and the flames and the altars. You have abandoned me. I do not know how to begin to reproach you. Did you not want your sister's company when you were dying? You could have called me to share your fate, and we would both have died in the same moment of the same grief. To think it was my hands that built the pyre, and my voice that called upon the gods of our fathers, so that you could be so cruel as to lay yourself down here to die without me. It is not only yourself you have destroyed, but also your sister and your people, their leaders who came with you from Sidon, and the city you have built. Give me water. I shall wash her wounds and catch any last lingering breath with my lips." Saying these words, she had climbed to the top of the pyre and was now holding her dying sister to her breast and cherishing her, sobbing as she dried the dark blood with her own dress. Once more Dido tried to raise her heavy eyes, but failed. The wound hissed round the sword beneath her breast. 3 times she raised herself on her elbow. 3 times she fell back on the bed. With wavering eyes, she looked for light in the heights of heaven and groaned when she found it. All-powerful Juno then took pity on her long anguish and difficult death, and sent Iris down from Olympus to free her struggling spirit and loosen the fastenings of her limbs. For since she was dying not by the decree of fate or by her own deserts, but pitiably and before her time, in a sudden blaze of madness, Proserpina had not yet taken a lock of her golden hair or consigned her to Stygian Orcus. So Iris, bathed in dew, flew down on her saffron wings, trailing all her colours across the sky opposite the sun, and hovered over Dido's head to say, "I am commanded to take this lock of hair as a solemn offering to Dis, and now I free you from your body." With these words, she raised her hand and cut the hair. And as she cut, all warmth went out of Dido's body, and her life passed into the winds.